renegade economist is saying yeah.
Economics for activists. Economics is being made. Economics. These are the tools activists need. How can we calculate it? What motivates them? And why do people spend money? Understand the basics to economics.
Cyber rents. Why are we paying so much on the internet? Freedom of speech or freedom to make profits? Today we speak to blogger extraordinaire, Mr. Jim Stogdill, right here on the Renegades.
Study in 1970, and you were trying to invent the most outlandish case of the perfect business. You know, that's what you would invent, something that cost nothing to distribute, but gave you essentially complete lock-in, incredible ability to attract profits.
And that is the story that Jim Stogdill will be discussing coming up soon on the show here on the Renegade Economists. The World Wide Web, supposedly part of the information age. We're all out there battling to form communities. Maybe you're doing it through permablitzes, which I must report the other week's permablitz at our house was absolutely fantastic. We had so much fun and must thank the Permaculture Out West mob for coming and beautifying our backyard. I must write up a little document to send to them that anyone engaging in a permablitz activity, and for those who don't know about it, it's where about 50 volunteers on a stormy day came to our house and dug the place up, planted a whole pile of gardens, and yeah, we are growing food. And of course, being renegade economists, you'd be catching on to the fact that that would increase our land value. So perhaps some sort of caveat or agreement, memorandum of agreement is signed with a permablitz group before this activity takes place, that if you do profiteer off other people's hard work, namely this beautiful permaculture setup, that some of that profit is shared back with the community that added to their good luck. So I promise you, we won't be selling our house anytime soon, but yeah, cheers to the permablitz crew. And perhaps your way of creating a community is engaging in the online world, and so much is going on in the mass online gaming world. And recently, just as a explanation of what's going on, there's a game called Entropia. Many of you would have heard of Second Life, would have heard of us discuss in the past about how property speculation in the virtual world blew the game out and people couldn't start up businesses. It was just too expensive. So the Second Life mob set up a land rent system, and from that, I think you have to pay about $5 US a month. It pulled back the speculative intent and businesses started to evolve again. Well, the competition to Second Life is called Entropia, and these guys seem like the neocons of the online gaming world, and they encourage speculation, it seems. They've licensed in 2007 some private banks which online players can buy and engage in trade in. And of course, there's no land rent system in Entropia, and they seem to use these massive online profits as a cheap tool for marketing their game. And so recently, a world record was set for virtual real estate, and a floating asteroid nightclub was sold for $335,000 US. So much money is being made in the online world. And many of you may well know of the concept called cyber squatting, where people buy up something. One of the most famous examples here in Australia was Telstra.com was bought up and tried to be sold to our major telco company for $100,000 in the 90s. And of course they said, "No, up your ass, we're going to start our own web company, website up." So they came up with BigPond.com. So yeah, we're paying about Well, in LA, as I discussed in the interview, you pay $20 per month to download your emails and get unlimited access to the internet. Here in Melbourne, somewhere between $60 to $70 with a cap of somewhere around about 50 gigabytes. And just caught up with my friend Shana from Skaterstan, and she was telling me that it's $500 US a month to get access to the internet, super slow speeds. But who on earth is making all the money out of these situations? And the world of technology has sped ahead of where governments are. Stephen Conroy likes to think that he's up with it all, but we're just about to auction off the 4G spectrum. And we've discussed before how the value of Optus shares and so forth have gone up since the iPhone, since new technology came onto the market, giving all these people ease of access to their emails wherever they are. The mobile office, we never stop working. Well, yes, with the 4G spectrum about to go up, it's going to be on for young and old with technology. All sorts of iPads and so forth will be coming up, and from that the electromagnetic spectrum will always be more and more valuable. So should we sell this in one flat auction? Some Kerry Stokes like a media mogul buys it up, holds it for another 5 years or so, and then sells it at triple the profit. Is that the sort of system we want? Because if he sells that at triple the profit, that price is passed on and the rest of us have to pay instead of $70 a month, maybe $100 a month. And that really is a secret tax the wealthy charge the poor. So Jim Stogdill recently wrote a key article called Control Points Equals, or called Points of Control Equals Rents. Amazing article. Look out for it at radar.oreilly.com. Here we go very soon with our discussion with Jim Stogdill. And there is some background hum to this Welcome interview.
Back. We have Jim Stogdill on the line. Jim is a online blogger at radar.oreilly.com. You can also see his personal website, jimstogdill.com, as well. A few weeks ago, you wrote a very interesting piece on radar.com. And the article was Points of Control Equals Rents. And this immediately got my radar going, because we've opened up a whole new land in this digital age where the pursuit of profits in these frontiers of change has left open the regulatory door, and with that the economic door to what's known as rent-seeking behavior. Jim, can you give us a background to that article and what you were trying to discuss, and perhaps starting off with what rent-seeking is?
You know, I've been sort of watching this industry unfold for a long time, and rent-seeking, plainly, simply, is just seeking profits above the opportunity cost. And traditionally, the term came from things like chartered corporations. And the implication is that if you're obtaining rents, you're basing them either on innovation or on some kind of lock-in. Innovation rents tend to be ephemeral, so oftentimes, as industries mature, they switch to other approaches to trying to achieve them. And I think the technology space is beginning to mature to the point where we're starting to see some of the kind of behaviors that we've seen in previous generations of technological change. The kinds of things we're seeing now are just the transition towards app stores, you know, where Apple in particular is sort of combining business models now to achieve greater lock-in. So probably more relevant are the kinds of behaviors where you're seeing a lot more lobbying now coming out of the technology industry, is the recognition that policy has so much to do with whether or not you can continue to achieve the kinds of rents that were coming from, network effects and other things previously.
Can you explain to us a bit, for those who aren't in the tech lingo, a bit about what network effects are?
The classic case is sort of something like the Microsoft Windows operating system. The more people used it, the more valuable it became, because it became an ecosystem for developing applications and that sort of thing. So the classic example is the telephone system, where one telephone is not very, very useful, but if everybody has a telephone, it's much more useful. And generally, it's viewed that the use of a network like that increases as the number of nodes on it are squared. So lots of times in the technology space, somebody gets an early head start on something, or either through some luck or maybe a smart move, and then if they get out ahead, that lock-in that comes from the network effect, that sort of having more nodes than anybody else, can keep propelling their business long after the innovation starts to taper off. So things like eBay, Facebook, the Microsoft Windows operating system, others, each place where you sort of get out ahead, and then just the sheer magnitude of your presence continues to propel you along.
And from that then, the world of there's less money spent on research and development and perhaps more money channeled towards lobbying Washington.
Well, I think initially it may actually propel research and development. I mean, I think Google is a great example of that. They have been able to take advantage of the network effects associated with their platform to sell ads, and that's driven investment in all kinds of other areas. The bulk of their revenue still seems to be coming from that primary ad business, but it's spun off research in all kinds of other areas. Where you start to see the kind of troubling transition to focus on patents and lobbying and copyright and those things are when that core franchise starts to decay a bit. So, for example, I think if Bing, for example, were to really take off in competition with Google's core search franchise, you'd probably see a lot more of that kind of behavior happening then. I think the thing that's interesting to me, I should just sort of kind of get this out in front. The reason I wrote this and the thing that was interesting to me about it is I'm not trying to take necessarily a position on rent taking, although I guess in general I have sort of a jaundiced view of the transition I think the industry's in now, but really the point of writing this for me was sort of a framing exercise. It was just usually the discussions of the web and sort of the computing industry are talked about in very technical terms. People focus on the technologies, let's talk about Linux, or let's talk about open source and how it's coded, or those kinds of things. And what was always interesting to me was to try to view this through some of the more, how would an MBA view it, or how would an economist view what's happening in these places. So when you look at the transition from proprietary software to open source software, for example, and there's certainly technical things involved in that transition, but to me the more interesting thing is that the shift in production method completely changes the sort of the leverage equation in the space. Whether you look at music or films or open source software versus proprietary software, in all these places as they go digital, what's really happening at a kind of a higher level is a shift in leverage, which changes the ability of any of those industries to take rents.
One of the challenges in the marketplace is ensuring there is competition, and that keeps companies honest and brings these rents back to more normal levels of profit. And for myself, I was never a IT savvy type person, but sort of the late 90s, early 2000s, we were having to pay people $3,000 to $4,000 to build a website for us and maintain it for a year. And now, through the open source community, predominantly through WordPress, I've learned how to do much of that myself, and just have to pay someone about $600 a year to help me with some of the more tricky technical things. So that's an example of the rents dropping over time with competition. But really, this open source community, this battalion of volunteers and computer geeks, do such a fantastic job for all of us computer users. How does it feel for yourself being involved in the open source community? Is there enough respect for what you guys do?
I think it's growing. I mean, I think, within the sort of corporate world, you're seeing a lot more focus on open source. And, what's interesting is that people assume that focus is just based on cost, but often it's really driven as much by the ability to control their destiny. I think that's an area where there's a lot going on in terms of growing understanding. The company I work for last year did a survey of, I believe, the Fortune 500, and found really accelerating adoption at the top of those organizations for open source. The interesting thing will be whether or not corporate entities really begin to contribute to open source and get beyond the notion of just sort of consuming it as another option.
The challenge between the people and these giant multinational companies, for so long we've seen Apple Mac as one of the good guys, but I was shocked to hear recently that they're charging upwards of 30% commissions on any book sold through their application store. Now, usually rents charged are around about 10%. What's the growing feeling there with this network lock-in that's going in with all these fans of this beautiful technology of iPad and so forth?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. And I think, it's going to, we're sort of on this threshold. Are we about to see, the Windows franchise managed to sort of lock everybody in for a couple of decades, and so we're now sort of on this threshold of, is there going to be a next version of that, and who's it going to be, and to what degree, right? So certainly Apple with its App Store approach and all this, and various approaches to content with iTunes, et cetera, are making a strong play to try to do that. And if they do, they'll be in a position, it's sort of the classic distribution model approach to market strength, and they'll extract a lot of value out of that for a long time if they pull it off. It's really tough to predict the future on this kind of thing, though. Things change really quickly. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, I've written other pieces about the Apple work, about the iPad, where I basically said it's not a computer, it's a distribution channel. And I have a lot of this, kind of concern about, if they manage to combine really good product, the technology itself, sort of the bright and shiny, object that we all desire, with a really powerful network effect model, they'll get a lot of market power out of that.
And within this wide new digital landscape where so many of these profits are being made, so much of it relies on the actual distribution network itself, the cabling, the electromagnetic spectrum that much of information is broadcast on, particularly for iPhones. How does it feel analyzing this lock-in mentality and lock-up mentality when governments are auctioning in a one-off deal 4G spectrum, which will really open up the capabilities of iPhones and iPads?
One of the things that I find really fascinating is that the iPhone in particular connected the telecoms and the computing world in a way that they hadn't really connected before. I mean, traditionally, cell phone providers and the carriers kind of lived in one world, and the Silicon Valley computer and software folks lived in a different world. They didn't really connect much. But with iPhone and now Android, there's this sort of cross-fertilization going on. And the carriers have, because of the spectrum management stuff, and as you mentioned, the spectrum auctions, they are about as close to a traditional, chartered monopoly as you still sort of get in our modern economy. I mean, you literally, buy the rights from the government for some certain monopoly. That traditionally, that approach, those regulated industries that were regulated with that kind of approach, have a certain kind of way of approaching their markets. And it's going to be kind of interesting to see their DNA get spliced into the Silicon Valley firms that traditionally operated on a basis of innovation to retain profits. Yeah, I don't know exactly how it's going to work out, but it would be wonderful if there was an alternative approach to dealing with spectrum issues rather than auctioning them off the way we're doing it now. It'd be
The best system, and the one that we promote, is a leasing of the spectrum, and the spectrum is valued yearly, and whoever owns that pays a lease fee back to the government, aka the community, And right. from that, some of these immense profits that are being siphoned off by the AT&Ts of the world is being shared back with the community. Because what right really do these companies have to lock off part of this gift of nature?
Yeah, for me, I mean, you know, I haven't thought tremendously about that, but for me, it's not just that the money would get, you know, basically funneled back into the community. It's that once you sort of locked in that stream, there's no longer much need to innovate. I guess with the leasing approach, if the leases are up each year, then you still have to innovate to kind of stay in a position to own that lease. But there are, you know, there are other folks. This is much more fringe, I think, but things like cognitive radio and that give you much more opportunity to sort of share spectrum. You know, some people are advocating the idea that maybe you don't have to do that at all. Maybe you don't even have to protect the spectrum. Maybe you just leave it out there and let the devices be smarter about how they use it and share it.
What is cognitive radio? Never heard of that.
It's the idea where radios are attentive to what's going on in the spectrum around them and can frequency shift in response to conditions. So if there's available spectrum, they can use it.
Gee, that sounds very interesting.
Yeah.
We're discussing with JimStogdill.com, StogdillL.com, IT expert.
Part of the problem we've got is that the digital era has created a digital divide, and many people can't afford to access what should be the ultimate source of information, this World Wide Web. And part of that problem is here in Australia, we're having to pay somewhere around $50 to $70 a month to get access to limited access to just 50 gigabytes download. I know in LA, for example, it was $20 unlimited. Nobody had ever heard of a cap when I was there last year. So if there was some way to grab some of these profits and use them, recycle them back to the community, we could get rid of, you know, maybe income tax or the sales tax or something like that. And on an economics front, that is sort of what I was thinking you were hinting at with the article you wrote.
Wherever you find prices, you know, to be high like that, whether it's electrical utilities in the third world or in information utilities like we're talking about here, oftentimes you will find a systematic rent-taking situation. And because once sort of that framework's in place, there's little motivation to extend the service. You actually sort of achieve what you're trying to achieve by constraining the service. Two approaches, you know, I'm not going to argue one over the other, but two approaches are, one is to sort of take the rents and use them for redistribution of the service, sort of what you're describing. And another one is to sort of eliminate through changes and or elimination of the regulation so that the market can adapt to it. Either approach can be advocated for. I tend to lean towards the latter. But if you do find a situation where sort of like where you see that arbitrage situation where in one area something's very cheap and in another area it's very expensive, it's probably a result of some structural thing that's creating rent taking. The interesting thing here is the connection between innovation and rent taking, but then in particular how it does kind of create a feedback loop back into the political system. You know, the things where I get concerned are where you see, you know, this shifting landscape put industries essentially on the defensive, you know, raise the anxiety level. Industries that have had very high rents. I mean, you look at the computing industry. I mean, if you were an MBA doing a case study in 1970 and you were trying to invent the most outlandish case of the perfect business, you know, that's what you would invent, something that cost nothing to distribute but gave you essentially complete lock-in, you know, incredible ability to attract profits. But as those things begin to sort of get flattened out over time, you know, we do see a lot more emphasis now on, you know, people trying to extend copyright, people lobbying for proprietary software to limit the inroads of open source software, those kinds of behaviors. And those things are really disconcerting to me, because not just because they sort of stall the natural progression of sort of rent decay, the kind of Schumpeterian creative destruction kind of stuff, but that they create the possibility of patronage networks in the political system. You know, in the U.S. now, the recent Supreme Court decision on Citizens United makes it much easier for corporations to influence the political process. In the tech industry, we think in terms of sort of, you know, this kind of happy, wonderful stuff. It's all innovative. It's making everybody happy. It's really cool stuff. It's stuff we couldn't do before. But really, at some fundamental level, it's no different than, say, maybe the oil and rail barons 100 years ago. You know, everybody loved them when they were pounding the golden spike and, you know, spanning continents with rail. But, you know, 50 years later, when they were using the sort of tail-end profits of that to, you know, buy the political process, it looked very different. And this industry is not any different. We're going to go through that same kind of thing.
On the people's side, in the last few days and weeks, the presence of WikiLeaks has certainly grown, and with that, the spreading of information has helped keep governments honest with this age of cyber snooping and spying. I wonder what your views are on the government future of the web, and in this neoliberal era, private companies have been able to gain control of some of the most essential elements of this distribution network, and from that, everything from the cabling of fiber optics, which is happening throughout Australia, hopefully over the next year or two, at a huge cost of $43 billion. That's been a huge issue here. But one of the big ones that got away from government is the actual registration of internet IP addresses, and a company named VeriSign was a front runner there, and somehow got the capability to license people's web addresses and charge $100 a year for that ability.
Yeah, talk about an opportunity for rent taking, right? Yeah.
So do you think there'll ever be a situation where the government will say, listen, enough's enough, this really is a natural monopoly, just like the robber barons had with the railways? This should be publicly owned, and we the people are going to either regulate against it or buy it back off VeriSign and others.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I mean, I guess it depends on sort of like how frustrated people get with it, right? I mean, that's sort of the political process happens at the polls, but it also happens in opinion. Problem is once the sort of infrastructure for rent taking is in place, then you've also got, you know, you immediately created a patronage network from it. And, you know, it'd be interesting to look at whether companies like that are putting in place, you know, political action committees and things like that to be able to funnel dollars. I think the other interesting, you know, the other area to sort of be thinking about all this is, you know, Facebook and things like it definitely raise an interesting question about, I mean, how much of the lock-in that we'll face in the future comes from the data, and not just the data, but the relationships that are, you know, in that data, you know, the connections to other people, et cetera, that'll potentially can create that. A lot's in play right now in terms of kind of what it's going to end up looking like.
Won't it be interesting to see if they develop some sort of relationship software between who we know on Facebook, where we spend our money, how often we spend it, and the products to those subset markets.
Yeah.
All right, Jim. Well, fantastic discussing the world of cyber rents with you, and we look forward to following your work on radar.oreilly.com.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.